Bad Actors by Peter Allison. When you work in any form of tourism, you come to understand how the stereotypes of certain countries form and can dread encounters with people based solely on their nationality. As a safari guide, however, you spend more time with individual clients than you would working in a hotel, so you get to see beyond the arrogance of the French, the volume of the Americans, the snobby reservedness of the English, the drunkenness of the Australians, and the utter lack of humour of the Germans. It teaches you not to judge someone just because of where they are from, and to stop refusing to guide New Yorkers. Not all people are defined by the places they are from. On occasion, though, an individual appears who seems determined not to break the mould in which their nationality is cast, but to reinforce it. Such a man was Supirabagu, as he came to be known on his brief safari in northern Botswana. He epitomised the image of the Japanese tourist who always has a camera in his hand and will take a photograph of anything. I pitied whoever would be forced to endure his slideshows as he snapped away at the tent he stayed in, the bed in his tent, the wardrobe in his tent, the zipper on his tent, the luggage in his tent. These were just the shots taken while inside, and he took painstaking care in setting up each shot, ensuring his focus and subject were just right. It was actually rare for us to have Japanese tourists at our camp, mainly because the Japanese usually travel in large groups and want their own food, and we only had 20 beds and cooked whatever we could get flown in from the nearest town. Yet, once or twice a year, a group of intrepid Japanese would arrive. And as I spoke a little of the language, it was inevitable that I would be allocated to guide them. The first sign that something was wrong was the way the plane landed. The pilots in the Okavango are good, really good. They land and take off more times in a day than almost any other commercial pilots in the world, and they do it on dirt strips with unusual crosswinds, sporadic dust storms, and the more than occasional animal that wanders onto the field. So it struck me as odd the way the twin engine whumped down, hitting hard onto the strip and not bouncing back up like a light aircraft should. It taxied over and the pilot shook his head at me through his window. Then came the second sign of problems brewing. First out of the plane were two 20-something girls who'd obviously thought long and hard about the suggested khaki-coloured clothes for safari and had rejected the prospect. They were arrayed in a clash of canary yellow and a shade of pink so lurid it could make Barbie puke. Most animals are colourblind, so it wasn't really a problem, but I was always nervous about people who were defiant in a place where the wrong behaviour could get you eaten. As the seventh person exited the aircraft and started hauling out his gear, my foreboding increased. Any travel agent stresses to a client that they will be travelling in very small bits of motorised tin and their luggage weight should reflect that. In fact, it is set at a strict 25 pounds. But looking at the camera bags and tripods being wrestled from the cargo area, I could tell that this guy had gone well over that. There was only one way he could have achieved this, and it would have involved a feigned or real misunderstanding of English when the pilot protested. "We almost died," it was the pilot, his New Zealand accent being pushed through clenched teeth. "We were overweight because every time I tried to take a bag out, he just said, 'Hey!' and shoved it back in. Then in mid-flight, he started taking photos, which is no problem, but when I pointed out some hippos, he leaned over the top of me and shoved me into the controls." He gave a hiss to show how stupid this was. "Not one of them screamed when we went into a dive. What sort of people are they?" He wasn't looking for an answer, so I didn't give him one. We both knew, anyway. These sorts of people could be from any country. They thought that Africa was a theme ride and didn't take its dangers seriously. They were a hazard to themselves and to anyone who had to keep them out of harm's way. like me. I looked at the vehicle, which the group had swarmed on to take their seats. It now bristled with tripods and lenses. They looked back at me, smiling. Ikimashu ka? I asked. Shall we go? There was a flurry as it dawned on them that I had spoken in their language, which rose to a hubbub before settling down to polite introductions. And you must be Spielberg, I said to the one with all the camera gear, including an expensive-looking video rig. Tsubiru Bagu is how it's pronounced in Japanese, and they all laughed. It's the sort of inoffensive joke you are always making when people are paying for you to be nice to them. Spiro Bagu just smiled and, without preamble, said, I would like to film a lion killing something. I could tell by the way he said it that he considered himself somewhat magnanimous to not be specific about the prey. I wanted to explain that when he watched a documentary, the half hour of footage he saw probably took more than a year to film, that the makers of it spent every waking hour and more in the bush, enduring months of tedium for the one gory moment of triumph. But unfortunately, my Japanese is not that good. We'll see, I said instead, and we started making our way to the camp. Along the rough track that led back to camp, we saw our first animals, and after their reaction, I was forced to explain the fundamental thing that guides hate most to have to explain. How's your group? My friend Lloyd, the manager, asked once we were in the camp. I had to tell them the basics, I said. No. True. In English or Japanese? Bit of both, most of it in Japanese. The swear words in English. Lloyd pondered this. Are you sure they understood?
I think so. Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Because one of them is on the deck throwing bread to a warthog. Shit, I said, and went off to repeat the speech I had already made in the vehicle after the group had leapt from the vehicle en masse. The exodus occurred because we had seen some impala, which had scattered in panic at the marauders. These were not zoo animals, I explained. They were wild. We didn't feed them, stroke them, or stand next to them for photographs. In fact, all we did was watch them live and die. I was, in fact, thankful for the little incident, and that the first thing we had seen had been an antelope herd. If we'd encountered an elephant, it might have made my point for me, but with a lot less delicacy. This happy fantasy sustained me while I reiterated my point to the young lady who was lobbing crusts at the bemused but not ungrateful pig. The game drives proceeded relatively well during their stay, though Spirobogo insisted on giving stage directions to every animal we saw and grew increasingly frustrated at their inability to understand him. One species had him particularly vexed. For some reason that no behaviorist has ever explained, zebras are the most notorious bum flashers. You can guarantee every time you are ready to take their photo that they will turn and show off their striped derriere. After perhaps the 30th such time that Spirobagu had faced such an indignity, he shouted at the zebra to stand still. These animals only speak Setswana, I said facetiously. Ask the staff to teach you some. Later that evening, I saw him in earnest conversation with Mollen, our barman, who spoke limited English and, to the best of my knowledge, spoke not a word of Japanese. Yes, I would hear the ever-cheerful Mollen say periodically, this is Botswana! Clearly, they had a communication breakdown, because while I listened for and looked forward to hearing Japanese-accented Setswana commands given to the animals, I never heard one. Spirobagu did use some of the rare Japanese expletives, though. It is a language almost devoid of swear words, and it is only with great creativity that you can insult as foully as is possible in English. His tirade was directed at a giraffe, one of the few animals that had actually appeared to follow his directions, briefly, anyway. The giraffe had been feeding on a tall acacia tree, his head buried deep in the thorny branches, rendering him unphotographable.
When he was done, it would seem most likely that he would head deeper into the thicket of trees to feed some more, rather than the more aesthetically pleasing option of crossing the open plain behind him. "Come out!" Spiru Bagu commanded. Miraculously, the giraffe did. It made its stately way for two of its long, swinging paces, then stopped to face us. A $1 million-a-day supermodel couldn't have posed more splendidly. Then again, the supermodel probably wouldn't start to openly urinate either, which is what the giraffe did. The stream came thick and gooey, and I explained to the group that giraffes are at their most vulnerable to lions when they lean down to drink, so they do everything they can to conserve water, including a biological process that leaves their piss thick and honey-like. The incensed Spiru Bagu was shouting at the giraffe. Another thing I had repeatedly asked the group not to do was call out to the animals, but this was too amusing for me to stop him. "Stop pissing, stupid animal! Can't you see I'm trying to take your photo?" Once again, the giraffe appeared to listen. After a last few stringy gloops, it stood magnificently posed for just a moment with the glorious green backdrop of the Okavango framing it. Then, too quickly for Spiru Bagu to gather his wits and focus, the giraffe promptly stepped back into the acacias and walked away. On our last drive together, we had set out for a particularly beautiful part of the Okavango, where huge herds of antelope could be found on a permanently green plain. I was always open to disruption to my plans, because if we didn't reach a destination, it could only mean that we had found something better to look at. So it was with no disappointment that I saw fresh lion tracks on the dirt road we were using. With no thought as to how hypocritical it might look, I stepped out of the vehicle to take a better look. Guides do this all the time, insist it is way too dangerous for anyone else to get out of the car or even stand up in it, then stroll around themselves as if their khaki uniform makes them invulnerable. The tracks were really fresh. "Very new, only a few minutes old," I told the group, following the tracks a little farther along the soft dust of the road. "It's an adult female. No, two adult females." I knew these lions. We were in the territory of Martina's Pride, a small group of only two adults, in which one of the females was unusually large and, even more bizarrely, had a scraggly mane. I suspected that the non-hairy female had given birth to cubs recently, so I was excited that we might see them. To make sure that the lions hadn't just crossed the road and moved into the thick bush on my left, I walked a little farther, not thinking of how much I was isolating myself from the vehicle. I was hoping that the lions would be somewhere on the plains to my right, where it would be easier to spot them. "Hey!" I shouted back to the eager faces who were peering over the back of the open-topped Land Rover. "There are tracks of little cubs here!" I took a few more steps. "It looks like the cubs went this way," I pointed into the bush, "and the adults went this way," I said, aiming my other arm out toward a complex of termite mounds. Then, still in the cruciform position, I spoke, this time only to myself. "Stupid, stupid, stupid, stupid," and at the fourth stupid, they came at me. When you are training to be a guide, you learn that the African bush is a much safer place than you might imagine. Once you've learned a few rules, you are less likely to get injured than a person in the city who faces traffic every day. Dealing with the dangerous animals becomes something as habitual as looking both ways when you cross a road. What you also learn is that there are things you can do in the bush that are like crossing a busy road with your eyes shut and ears blocked. The first thing they teach you as a guide is that you never get between a lion and her cubs. It's the second thing they teach you as well, just to reinforce it, and usually they reiterate it a third time for good measure. I'd just forgotten to look both ways, and Martina and her sister, who I had seen ripping other animals to pieces on a number of occasions, were coming at me. I felt naked and cold, despite the desert sun. I let the training that I had not forgotten take over. My arms were already raised, which had the advantage of making me look bigger. I turned to the lions, front on, showing that I had forward-facing eyes like them and all other predators. This is meant to make them hesitate. I tried to roar, but as always happened to me in these circumstances, what came out was more of a pathetic whimper. They weren't coming in a straight line at me, but were bouncing, stiff-legged from side to side, getting incrementally closer. This, the books tell you, is an almost sure sign of a mock charge, and the lions will probably stop before they get to you and will then back off. The knowledge that the lions weren't sure yet that they were going to kill me was little comfort, and I was barely relieved when they stopped about 20 feet from me. They backed slowly away, the ridge of fur along their spine erect, their faces twisted into snarls, and low growls emanating and filling the air, seeming to come from every direction at once. I took a step back. They came again, bouncing once more from side to side, stopping closer to me than the time before. Again, the roar I gave was less than threatening. They backed away, bellies low to the ground, their focus as unwaveringly on me as mine was on them. When they stopped, tails twitching, I took a step back again. They charged. 3 times they came at me, their bouncing run impossible to track, yellow fur and a fury of teeth as they homed in. The 4th time they backed off, I stepped back again, getting another pace closer to the safety of the vehicle. This time, when they came straight. This is it, I thought, and gave maybe the only roar that I have ever managed that had some menace in it. They didn't slow, and it took only a second before they were at me. They ran straight past, close enough for me to reach out a hand and touch them, before I could even register that they weren't going to hit me. All that was left was a hole in the bush they had plunged through and their pungent odour as they had headed for the cubs they had been protecting. I wanted to sit down, but I did the right thing and continued slowly, shakily backing away. At the vehicle, I finally turned. Somehow all 7 of the Japanese had squeezed onto the seat at the back of the vehicle, which is designed for 3, to lean over and watch. Spirabagu had his video camera hanging loosely in his hand, lens cap on, a look of displeasure on his face. As I staggered into my seat, wanting to cry, wanting to puke, wanting to laugh and scream, he spoke. "I'm sorry, but I wasn't able to get that the 1st time. Would you mind doing it again?"